I'm sorry, it's the end, the conclusion of our exploration of generational conflict in the early church. And today, as you can see from the outline here on the board, we've got some important work to do. And I'll be counting on you to help me with this work. First, I'm going to lay out the assumptions that I'm making in attempting to reconstruct a plausible scenario of what happened in the church at Corinth. And then we're going to talk about implications for today, for the 21st century. So as you know, just to summarize what we've learned so far, sometime at the end of the first or the beginning of the second century, a report reached Rome from Corinth that the elders, the presbyters of the church at Corinth, some of them, in any event, had been deposed from office. Not just demoted, but cast out, Gary the Greek says. They had been cast out of office. And they had been replaced by other presbyters. So we're going to try together to figure out, first of all, how did that happen? Second, and more importantly, why? What was the motivation? All right, I have four assumptions that are based upon evidence in the text of 1 Clement, but not only in 1 Clement. I'm also drawing upon Paul's letters to Corinth and upon other Roman writings from this period, like The Shepherd of Hermas, a book that's in the Apostolic Fathers, a very long visionary apocalyptic writing. Okay, so I have four assumptions that I'm making. First, I assume that the organizational unit of Christian life at the end of the first, the beginning of the second century, was still the house church. Now, the earliest Christians didn't have church buildings set apart, right? They met in believers' homes. Good morning. House churches. And that's clear in Paul's letters. Gary, Paul has a little expression that he uses in Greek on many occasions. It's the expression, hei kat oikon ekklesia, which means
gathering at your house.
Yeah, the assembly, the gathering, the church, in a person's house. And Paul draws a contrast at a couple of points between those house church gatherings and the hole ekklesia, which means
the whole church.
The whole church, which comes together from time to time, especially to eat the Lord's Supper. So I'm assuming that this structure of early Christian life, house churches, which assembled from time to time, perhaps even on a weekly basis, they all came together to eat the Lord's Supper. Larry?
You're not implying that the house church did not have the Lord's Supper, are you?
No, I don't mean to imply that. Thank you for that question. In fact, some New Testament scholars, Gary, do you know Robert Jewett?
Sure.
A great old scholar who finished his career, by the way, Larry, after he retired here in the United States from Northwestern and Garrett. He finished his career at Heidelberg. He went to Heidelberg and continued to teach and do research to your school for 10 years. Robert Jewett argues that the early Christians probably had the Lord's Supper in the form of a communal meal every day.
He thinks it was every evening. Now, I'm not sure he can prove that, but I do think even from Paul's letters, it is clear that for the poor and for slaves, the communal meal was a source of what?
Nourishment.
Exactly. It was a source of nourishment because Paul says in 1 Corinthians 11, he says, on account of the unequal distribution of food and drink, some people have become what? Weak and sick. So for people who live below the subsistence level, I think the communal meal, the Lord's Supper, was a source of nourishment. In any case, this assumption, and I call it an assumption, because there's nothing in the pages of First Clement. There is no mention of house churches. I just have to admit that. But Paul's letters, written about 50 years before First Clement, make clear that the early Christians assembled in house churches, that that was the basic organizational unit of their life together. And a Roman writing contemporary with First Clement called The Shepherd of Hermas refers repeatedly to house churches and house church leaders.
So did any of the early Christians go to the synagogues?
Well, that's a good question. It all depended upon location. Has anyone here traveled through Turkey? Has anyone been to Sardis? You see, we just have to organize, Larry and Jim, we have to organize an Epiphany Lutheran Bethany. Oh, we do. We do. I volunteer right now to lead it. And Diane can bring the charm and, you know, grace and hospitality. There was a big city in Turkey, and now it's a huge archaeological excavation called Sardis. Sardis had a beautiful synagogue right on the edge of the town square. And it had mosaics and paintings. Diane has seen it. The Christian bishop of Sardis in the second century, early second century AD, named Melito, Melito of Sardis. Guess what survives that he wrote? It survives. We can read it today. His Passover homily. Wow! What does that tell you? The early Christ believers, Christians at Sardis, were observing what? Passover meal. Right. Down at Christ Church in downtown Dayton, we received in the mail an invitation to a Seder meal on Maundy Thursday, right? So I think there would have been places where the early Christians were not separated from the synagogue, or, I mean, if you're talking about that church in Sardis, one of the archaeologists, my mentor, Helmut Kester, has argued that the two niches that the archaeologists have found in the wall of the old Christian church in Sardis, one niche was for the New Testament, and the other niche was for what? The Old Testament, for the Torah. So I think the borderline between Christians and Jews was probably not a very clear one in some places. But we have to remind ourselves that Paul felt that he was called as the apostle to whom?
Gentiles.
The Gentiles. And there is no Pauline church in Sardis. Paul would have had to pass right through there on his way across Asia Minor. He didn't stop there. He didn't establish a church there. Why not? Because Sardis had the biggest Jewish community in Turkey. Affluent. And Paul was called to whom? The Gentiles, yes.
You said that they had a New Testament section within the synagogue.
Within the synagogue.
That the books of the New Testament weren't written until later. Is this after that time?
Before yes. The synagogue, if we get our travel group together, Pastor Jim, you will see that the synagogue that the archaeologists have excavated there is 4th century.
Okay.
4th century. So by that time, you've got...
canonization.
Yeah, you've got early Christian writings. So now, the assumption that the house church was the basic unit of Christian life, continued to be, at the end of the first, beginning of the second century, that assumption has implications. Let me make one implication clear. The owner of the house, the householder, who provided the place for people to meet, and probably also what? The food and drink for the Lord's Supper. That person would have been the de facto what? Patron, leader, exactly, of the church. And that's what we see in Paul's letters. Paul mentions several people whose households he baptized. Stephanus, Crispus, Gaius. And it's pretty clear that these people, from the way Paul talks about them, are the leaders of the churches that assemble in their house. That's the way Greek and Roman society was organized. It was a hierarchical society. We've learned that in our work together here. The patria potestas. The power of what? The father. Yeah. He had a monopoly on family resources. Now, when we think about these house churches, the house church would have included the family of the householder, his wife, children, who else?
Servants.
Business associates, clients, people who were economically dependent upon the householder. So how many people are we talking about? My Australian friend Don Barker, who is a papyrologist, wrote his dissertation. He wrote it on demographics. He investigated tax records, papyrus tax records from Egypt. And after looking at hundreds of those, he came to the conclusion that a typical household size in the first century would have been 20. 20 to 25 people, probably, gathering in the home. And they would have been, in some sense, economically dependent upon the householder. Now, one thing that First Clement does make clear is that these householders had the title Episkopos, which in this period, this early period, does not mean bishop. It means what?
Overseer.
And the reason I'm so sure about that is because in the Greco-Roman voluntary associations, right? The associations that worshipped Dionysus or Bacchic associations, the same title is used. And it describes the economic responsibility that a house church leader would have for the community. So I think we can imagine, plausibly, you know, reasonably, we can imagine that each one of the, let's say, 5 or 6 house churches in Corinth at the end of the first, beginning of the second century, had a householder, a patron, and that that person had financial responsibility for the group. First Clement makes clear that this person also had, Larry, liturgical responsibilities. And Clement says that the overseer offers the gifts. Prosphoring tadora, right? Brings forward, offers the gifts and the sacrifices. Now, that's a reference to what? Communion, I think, yeah. And even if it's not the Lord's Supper, even if we're talking about the sacrifices of prayer, right, rather than the elements of the Eucharist, we're still talking about a liturgical role, right, of some sort. All right, that's my first assumption that undergirds my reconstruction. Second assumption. My second assumption is that on occasion, perhaps every week, perhaps every month, the house churches came together in a holy ecclesia, a common assembly, a whole church. Now, what we don't know is whether this whole assembly came together in the home of one of the overseers. Did anyone have a house big enough, right, to host how many? 20 times 6? 120 people? That's...
They could rent the synagogue, don't they?
Yes, they could. And some scholars have proposed that when the whole church came together, they rented a hall of a guild or a club or a cultic association. A few years ago, Diane and I, when I was still teaching at the seminary, we gave a party for my beginning Greek class. And I had 60 students that year in the class, and I invited them to our house. We hired a little jazz band that played out on the patio behind our house. I told them they could bring their significant others. Guess how many people showed up? More than 100. And at 10 o'clock at night, there was a knock on the door of our old house up in the Dayton View. Guess who it was?
Please.
One of Dayton's finest, right? Shutting down at the request of our neighbors. So if there was a person at Corinth in the time of Clement who had a house big enough to host what? The whole church, 120 people or more. That wouldn't have been a house. It would have been a villa of some sort. Maybe there was such a person. I don't know. But the other alternative is that they rented on those occasions some kind of a hall. Now, when they met together as a whole church, it is very clear from things that Clement says that the leaders were the presbyteroi. So, the heads of the house churches, when they met in common assembly, they had a different title. Now they're not called episkopoi, they're called what? Presbyteroi. So, Clement clearly uses this language to describe the same people. But he's describing the same people in different locations and in different functions. Each house church had its own what? Overseer, patron. When they all met together, those overseers constituted a college or a council of elders. Exactly. The Shepherd of Hermas that I mentioned a few minutes ago talks about this presbyterial assembly. And in the Shepherd of Hermas, there are two places where it is clear that those elders, the presbyteroi, had the chief seats. They sat apart from the others when the whole church assembled. When we take our trip to Turkey together and we go to that synagogue in Sardis, behind the rostrum, there is a curved apse with seats, Larry, for about 9 people back there. Helmut Kester, you remember, said that's where the presbyters sat. They sat apart from, they had the chief seats when the whole church met. Okay, so those are my first two assumptions. Now, the assumption that I've been elaborating all throughout our weeks together, that the leaders of the revolt at Corinth that resulted in the deposition of some of the presbyters were young people. And you recall my evidence for that. 3 vectors of evidence point in that direction. First, the description that Clement gives of the revolt, highly rhetorical, in chapter 3. In rhetoric, it would be called the narratio, or in Greek, the diegesis. It's very short. But if you analyze the rhetoric of that chapter, Clement outlines four shocking reversals of good social order that have happened. And guess what climaxes that account? The young against the old. Rhetorically, he's following a law. It's the law of incremental sequence, where the most important member in the sequence is placed last at the climax. The second vector that points in the direction of the young are the allusions to Old Testament scripture and the quotations. They saturate First Clement. The Old Testament is the cipher through which Clement speaks. He lets the scripture do the talking for him. And when you go back and look at the context of each one of those scripture citations, which I have painstakingly done over the past 2 years, in every case, those Old Testament scripture citations contain warnings against the misbehavior of the young, and judgments upon the disobedience of the young, interspersed with positive examples of young people who were obedient and good. For example, David. The author introduces a quotation of one of David's psalms by recalling that when David was chosen as the king, he was what? A young boy doing what?
Shepherding.
But he was chosen because he was a man what? After God's own heart. Exactly. So it's the young David that is lifted up when you go chasing the context. Finally, the third vector that points toward the young is the language that Clement uses in characterizing, we might say caricaturing, the rebels. He uses the language rash, self-willed, foolish, impudent, disobedient. And if you get your Greek dictionary out, Larry, or your digital dictionary, the thesaurus lingua graeci, and if you chase the vocabulary that Clement uses to describe the rebels, this language is repeatedly used to describe what? Bad young people. Young people that are foolish and rash and self-willed and disobedient to their parents. So, that's my third assumption. Fourth assumption is that the young people who revolted were supported by certain women. And I think that's clear, first of all, in chapter 1, verse 3. Clement dissects, he analyzes the church at Corinth, and he says, on the one side, over here, you've got the leaders and the older people. To them, you ought to be obedient and submissive. On the other side, Clement says, you've got young people and women. And they need to be instructed. And they need to be submissive. It's even clearer in chapter 21. And feminist theologians like Elizabeth Schussler Fiorenza at Harvard, she would be outraged by a text like this. You know, she's a Deutsche Panzer and a powerful force, even though she's in her 80s. She has no intention to retire. But listen to what Clement says here in 1 Clement chapter 21. He said, let us respect those who rule over us, right? Let us honor the elderly. So that's one group, right, that deserves respect and honor. Now the other group. Let us instruct the young in the fear of God. Let us lead our wives to that which is good. And now he really takes off on the women.
21:7. Let them exhibit the lovely habit of purity. Let them show forth the innocent will of meekness. Diane, are you listening to this? Let them make the gentleness of their tongue manifest by their silence. And the next sentence is so telling. Let them not give their affection by factious preferences. Oh, that tells you a lot, doesn't it? These women have given their love and their support. How?
Through their dowries.
Yeah, through their dowries, as we discovered.
Yeah.
That was the only independent pot of money in a family. And they have given their love and their support with preferences. Right? And those preferences have created factions. Now, that's not all that the author has to say about women. He's really obsessed with women, if you go through the book. He gives positive examples of women who, in chapter 55, he gives three examples of women who followed their sons into voluntary exile. Also, he gives examples of bad women. Lot's wife, right? Who looked back and was turned into what? A pillar of salt. But he adds something to the text that's not there in the Old Testament. And this is so characteristic of Clement. If the text won't say what he wants it to say, he does what? He supplements it. He adds. And what he says is that the reason that Lot's wife was changed into a pillar of salt was that she did not remain in Greece. In
permissive.
She did not remain in homonoia, which means what, Gary?
Under a man or with a man.
Homonoia. One mind. She did not remain in concord with her husband, Lot. The text doesn't say that, right? The text never mentions that the reason that Lot's wife was turned into a pillar of salt was that she disagreed with her husband. No, it never says that, but Clement puts that in. That's what he wants it to say. And that tells you what has happened.
He was curious, wasn't he?
Maybe she was nostalgic for her home, right? She wanted to look back. Maybe she was curious to see if God really was going to rain fire. But Clement changes it. He says she was changed into a pillar of salt because she did not remain in one mind, the same mind, concord with her husband.
She had a flavor.
Yes. So those are my four assumptions. Now, the reconstruction. And I will acknowledge that these scenarios that I'm going to lay out are only plausible. I mean, Clement is a highly rhetorical work, Jim, as you realized. And Clement just doesn't give us sufficient detail to make the reconstruction certain. The evidence that he provides is not, as the lawyers would say, dispositive. But at least we can offer a couple of, I hope, plausible scenarios. And I'll ask you which one you think makes the most sense. You can help me by voting. Number one, it could be that the young people who revolted and deposed some of the presbyters were what we might call clients. So they are members of a house church. They are not the sons of the householder. They may be what? The sons of business partners or
servants,
clients. They are perhaps no more than neighbors, right? Perhaps they're neighbors that have joined a house church. And perhaps what's happened here is that one or more of these house churches have been overturned in terms of leadership by clients. Now, in favor of this scenario is what's said about the change of place where worship happens in chapter 40 of 1 Clement. The author says that the master commanded us to perform at appointed times and in fixed places the liturgical rites by persons according to God's good pleasure, the ones that are acceptable to His will. Now, that suggests that there has been a change of what?
Location.
Location.
That I was wondering if you had a revolt, but this guy owned the house, he'd say, yeah, I'm meeting here anymore, right?
So. Okay. So I think that's one possible scenario. That a person who belonged to a house church, not the son of the house, but an economic dependent, a client, the son of a business partner, he decided that the overseer of that house church was just not doing his job. He was hoarding the community resources. Perhaps he thought he was losing it. He was becoming mentally incompetent. Or perhaps he didn't like the theology of the house church leader. Perhaps the young person remembered the past when Paul involved young people in leadership, people like Timothy. So perhaps the leader of the revolt is a client. And then if that were the case, the householder would say what? Get out. And the client would probably be all too willing to let his supporters assemble where?
Somewhere else.
Somewhere else. Either in his house or in a rented hall. And that appears to be what's indicated by chapter 40. Now, here's the weakness of that reconstruction. Can you spot it? Remember that the house church leaders, the overseers, when the whole church assembles, they are the elders, the presbyteroi. Well, the old man who has suffered a withdrawal from his house church, why wouldn't he continue to assert that he's still a presbyter? You see, I can't figure out any reason why the separation of a group from a house church would have resulted in what? The deposition of the presbyter. The old leader of that house church would probably have continued to assert that his chair in the whole assembly belonged to him.
Well, and he would still have his own group.
He would.
In such a split, not everyone would.
That's exactly right. He would still have his group.
So that would be like increasing the number of groups as opposed to
exactly
changing the group.
Exactly. And so we come to the second scenario. And the second scenario is more frightening. But in my opinion, it has more going for it.
I think the revolt is a revolt not of clients, but of what?
Sons. That seems to me to explain all the evidence.
Sons of householders.
Yes. The son of a householder has deposed what?
His father.
His own father. All of the evidence that we explored last week about generational conflict points in that direction. The old man, the father, has a monopoly on what?
Family resources.
And he makes all the decisions. But there is one independent pot of money.
Mother.
The dowry.
So in the second scenario, a son has deposed his own father using his mother's money and with her support. That would have, right, if the son has replaced the father as the overseer of the house church, that would result in what? A change at the level of the presbytery. The son would replace the father in the presbyterial council. How that makes the most sense to me, I have to admit. Can you all see any other possibilities? Well, we did notice that in chapter 54, when Clement offers his advice about how to solve the problem in the church at Corinth, he composes a speech which he puts into the mouth of one person, the leader of the revolt. Is there anyone among you, Clement says, who is noble? Is there anyone who is compassionate or full of love? Let that person, singular, let him say, if sedition and strife and divisions have arisen on my account, I will what? Depart. In Greek, Gary, it's so dramatic. Echoro. I will go away. I will go out. Ape me. I will depart. I will go away wherever you wish. Only let the flock of Christ have peace with the presbyters set over it. That's the little speech. And then Clement promises, if someone does this, he will win for himself. Notice, all of the pronouns are what?
Singular.
He will win for himself great glory in Christ. And he will find that every place will receive him. So he tells this person, if you'll just leave, Christian communities in other cities will take you in. So here's a possibility. Let's say that the leader of the whole revolt is what? The son of a house. And he starts the whole thing. Clement tells that person that he ought to do what? Leave. Leave the Christian community in Corinth. But in chapter 57, Clement offers different advice to a larger group. In 57, Clement says, let me read it for you. He says, you therefore, and now the pronoun is plural. In Greek, Gary, humes, right? You, plural. You who laid the foundation. You who provided what? The support. You who laid the foundation. For the stasis, the sedition, you should submit to the presbyters and receive the correction of repentance, bending the knees of your heart. Learn to be submissive. So a larger group of people who laid the foundation of the uprising are not told to depart. They're told to what? Bow down in place, right? Submit in place. So, I think it is possible that these two scenarios could be what? Combined.
Especially if the clients are like apprentices or whatever.
Yes.
They were there to learn from maybe the guy with the lawyer or
right.
Author or whatever. The sons could certainly get them to go along, but vice versa very well.
Right. So, maybe there's something like a contagion here. It starts with the son of a house, or maybe two or three sons who replace their father. And then that creates unrest in other house churches. People that are now beginning to agitate and are asking, why must all of the authority and the leadership reside in the elders?
It wasn't like that in the time of Paul.
To me, it implies that the mothers are also rebellion.
I think so, yes.
They help their sons. They're in cahoots.
They're in cahoots with their sons, yes. And I didn't read for you. I probably should have. In chapter 55, after he tells the leader of the revolt to take himself into voluntary exile, then he gives a bunch of examples of women who have gone out in order to keep the peace. So many women received power. Blessed Judith, when her city was besieged, asked the elders to let her go out of the camp. And so she gave herself up and went out for love of her country. Not less did Esther also, who was perfect in faith, deliver herself from danger, departing from the community and rescuing the nation of Israel. So I think he's telling some of the women, at least the mother of what?
The ringleader.
He's telling them they've got to go away too.
But I can see them being behind the scenes too.
Yes, I think you're right. Yes, Pastor Jim.
My question was, when you start a new church, how would you get standing in the presbytery? Because it seems like the number one scenario, you'd have a growth strategy because you'd have all these new house churches going, and so then how would the leader, which would be the young person, how would they get standing in the governance of the presbytery? Because what's the process?
What's the process? Right.
Because then you have a flood of younger presbyters.
Right. Right.
So did that happen?
Did that happen? Right. I think the question that you're raising is another
argument that speaks in favor of scenario two. The revolt of the sons.
Well, you have precedence of Rebecca sending out Jacob.
That's right.
And to claim a
birthright.
And a dowry.
Yeah.
From her people.
Right, right. And he supersedes the elder, Esau.
And do you think you can combine the two for your book?
I hope so. What do you think? Do you think I can? We'll see how it comes out.
Another dichotomy that I see on this isn't so much who leads the revolt, but why.
Thank you.
You have change and anti-change.
Right.
The entrenched and the reformers.
Right. My best reconstruction of the motive for the revolt goes like this. I think I observed several weeks ago that the author of this writing, the Roman Epistle, has what could be described at best an ambivalent attitude toward Paul. On the one hand, he wants to mobilize and utilize Paul's authority. He refers to Paul as a martyr. He quotes 1 Corinthians. He quotes Romans. But he doesn't really share Paul's theology, Paul's understanding of the life of faith. For example, he quotes Paul's body metaphor from 1 Corinthians 12. Now, you remember Paul said that the Christian community is like what? A body with many
parts.
And all of those parts are what?
Equal
and necessary. And the hand doesn't say to the eye, what? I don't need you. In Paul's body metaphor, there is no head. Have you noticed that? There is no head. In fact, just the opposite. Paul says God has arranged, he has knit together the body so that the inferior and shameful parts. What parts does Paul have in mind? This area, the groin area. Well, Paul says these things, right? He's more like Martin Luther than some people. Paul says the inferior and shameful parts have been given the greater honor by God, and that's why we do what?
Cover them up.
So, I'm not the first scholar to notice that Paul's body metaphor is radically democratic. All of the members of the body are necessary. There's a mutuality between them, and there's no hierarchy in Paul's body metaphor. Guess what Clement does with it? Clement appropriates the body metaphor from Paul, but he imposes what? A hierarchy. The body will function well, Clement says, when the other members do what? The head directs. And this is a pattern with Clement. Whenever he quotes Paul, it's like hermeneutical jujitsu. You know what jujitsu is? Yeah, you flip the other wrestler over using the other wrestler's momentum or body weight. Clement does that to Paul again and again. He quotes Paul's great hymn on love, 1 Corinthians 13, right? Diane's mother read that at my older son's wedding. I was so proud of her. She stood up there, 84 years old, and read that beautiful chapter on love. But guess why Clement quotes it? He says, he quotes Paul's hymn, and then he says, love will be realized when we exhibit concord with our leaders. He introduces into Paul's beautiful hymn what he really wants to say. So, here's my best guess about the motive. Paul's epistles continued to be read in the church at Corinth. We know that. Clement quotes them. So, they are familiar to the Corinthians. My guess is that some of the young people in the church at Corinth were inspired by Paul's understanding of the life of faith. They remembered a time when leadership did not have an age requirement, when the Spirit distributed gifts, a time that was when the church was Spirit-led and age-blind. And I think Paul was the ideological or theological motivation.
Paul also made it so it's not gender specific, and I imagine
right.
The women who were freed from that didn't want to give it up.
That's right.
In fact, in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, Paul mentions a woman, Chloe. That's not just the name of a French perfume, right? It's the name of a woman in the church at Corinth. Her people, hoi chloes, have come to Paul with information about factions in the church. Wayne Meeks and others, Gerd Tyson at Heidelberg, have argued that Chloe was a house church leader in the time of Paul. And we don't have to speculate about Priscilla. She and her husband, Aquila, are the leaders of a house church. Paul says so. And when, this is interesting, when the author of Acts mentions this famous missionary couple, Aquila and Priscilla, he always mentions Aquila's name first. But when Paul mentions this famous couple, guess what? The order is reversed. It's Prisca first, and then Aquila. Isn't that interesting? Okay, so that's the best I can do with a reconstruction. I hope it's plausible. I will admit that it is frightening, because you've got all the tensions that Sigmund Freud explored of the dynamic between, and that Dostoevsky explored in The Brothers Karamazov. You've got all of the tensions that exist between fathers and sons.
Right.
Yes.
As we know, the Greeks were the home of democracy.
Right.
Rome wasn't.
That's right.
Clement was Roman.
Yes.
And steeped in authoritarian.
Yes.
Right.
Right.
So
clearly.
A battle between there, which he puts in with the people too.
I think you're right about that. In the early second century, Corinth is beginning to reclaim its Greek past. Corinth was a Roman colony at the time of Paul, but you begin to see a change. Greek begins to replace Latin as the language of public discourse on inscriptions in about the year 120 at Corinth. So there's a cultural shift that's part of this too, I think. That may be one of the motives. Gary?
But we shouldn't romanticize Greek democracy.
No, that's true.
I mean, the demos was made of men.
That's true, it was.
Women were disenfranchised, true. Slaves. Men's slaves were disenfranchised.
True, well. True. The equality, right, that the Greeks said was the foundation of Greek democracy was an equality only between what? Male citizens, so free males who were citizens. That's quite right. Okay, now, in the short time that remains, I'd like to come to the implications for today. And I don't claim that I have understood all of these. Some of you, all of you, are probably in a better position to work this out than I am. But I'll start the conversation by just telling you what I've been thinking. The first implication of the kind of study that we have just been through together. You know, First Clement is not an inspiring book. It's not like reading the Sermon on the Mount, right? And finding yourself lifted up to God with inspiration. It's not like reading one of the great letters of Paul. First Clement is an important book because, as Harnack said, it was responsible for crushing the primitive democracy of the church led by Jesus and Paul. But I do think that the kind of study that we have done has implications for today. Number one, if we are right in locating the crushing of the young and the reinstatement of the old as the legitimate authorities in the life of the church, if we are right in locating that in First Clement, that's what Harnack thought, then there is a possibility that we can liberate ourselves from an oppressive past. This was something that happened, but it didn't have to happen. The church, the Christian movement, could have gone in a different direction. So, recognizing that the rule of the elders was reimposed upon the church at Corinth, and then through the growing influence of First Clement and the growing influence of what church? The church at Rome. The authority of the elders spread through the whole Christian movement. But it didn't have to be that way. So that's one consequence, implication of our study. Second implication, I think this kind of study motivates us to a retrieval of a better past. And some of your comments have already moved us in that direction. Recognizing that the church took a wrong turn here points us back to Jesus and the young men that he called from the fish, the nets where they were fishing. It takes us back to Paul and young men like Timothy and Onesimus and others were leaders in the church, along with women. So I think this kind of study makes it possible for us to retrieve a better past than the one that we have inherited. Finally, and this is where I'd like to spend our last few minutes together, for us today, I think we can, as a result of this study, recommit ourselves to the empowerment of the young as leaders of the church. We began by talking about Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Larry, I wonder if anyone has ever done a study of what those young men and women that Bonhoeffer trained in that alternative seminary of the Confessing Church that he started up in northern Germany. I wonder if anyone has ever followed up to see what impact did they have upon the Lutheran Church in Germany. I would love to see a book like that. My guess is that the conclusion of that kind of study would be that the redemption and the renewal of the Lutheran Church in Germany after the Hitler time, the resurrection of the church, right, toward a future, that it owed a good deal to members of the Bekennende Kirche, the Confessing Church. So there's a lesson there, right? There's a lesson. Bonhoeffer and a few others took a step, a courageous and dangerous step. He paid for it with his life, to empower young leaders. I think that's what we ought to be doing today in our churches. I serve as a consultant for something called the FTE, the Fund for Theological Education. Do you know about it? It gives money to young people that are going to seminary and even on to get a doctoral degree, a PhD degree. I was involved in a conference call with the board members of the FTE a couple of weeks ago. Took most of an afternoon in my little apartment in the Bronx. And after a soul-searching discussion of a couple of hours, we began to come to the conclusion that the support for young leaders in the church doesn't go down far enough. It needs to start in college or even at the end of high school, identifying people that have a call to ministry. It's not enough to begin at the level of seminary. It needs to start earlier. Now let me tell a story. When I was still teaching at United Seminary, a young man showed up from Zimbabwe with his very young wife. And in those days, he didn't have children. I taught him for 2 or 3 years. He turned out to be a great New Testament student. Eventually, I sent him on to get his PhD at Bright Divinity School, Texas Christian University. One day, in his last year at United Seminary, he came over to my house to work on his thesis, his senior thesis. And he began to tell me, we were sitting at my kitchen table in there, the breakfast room table, and he began to tell me his life story. Both of his parents had been imprisoned and killed in Zimbabwe. And then there was a moment that I'll never forget. His name was Israel, Israel Kamuzandu. He stood up in the breakfast room of my home and he took off his jacket and he proceeded to take off his shirt. And I wondered, what is going on here? And my son, the one that was just married, Locke, was a little boy and his eyes got all big. And after he had taken off his shirt, he turned around so that we could see his back. Guess what was there on his back? Torture marks. He had been horribly tortured. Okay, how did he get out of that? There was a United Methodist bishop named Emerson Colaw. Do you know him, Larry? He taught at United Seminary after he retired. What a great man. And he just passed away about a year ago. In fact, they've established a lectureship now at United Seminary in his honor. Bishop Emerson Colaw.
When he was traveling through Africa and passed through Zimbabwe, someone told him about a young man who had a calling to ministry, whose parents had been killed in prison, and who himself had been tortured. And guess what Emerson Kolaw did? He brought him here to the United States. He paid for his expenses to come here. He sent him to United Seminary. Well, guess where Israel Kamudzanu is today? Today he is the professor of New Testament and the associate dean of St. Paul Theological Seminary in Kansas City. Wow. He's published two books. One in a distinguished series in the Netherlands, E.J. Brill. The other by Fortress Press. Yeah, by the Lutheran Publishing House in the United States. So I just tell that story as an example, right, of how someone, Bishop Kolaw, rescued and empowered a young person, and he became a leader in the church. Larry?
You could take the Reformation and put it over top of this.
You could.
And obviously there was the strong, you could hardly get out of this this hierarchy. And Luther's rediscovery of priesthood of all believers, right, which included not only young people, but included women.
Right.
And eventually, he writes a lot about freedom, so that's number one. And he finds this by not return, which I think maybe the radical reformers did, mm-hmm, trying to recreate the past, but brings the past
into the present,
retrieves it,
yes.
And but it's all based on retrieving it from the scriptures,
right?
And then obviously they have the Wittenberg University for training young leaders. And I don't know that you can build the case that everybody who was in the old system was an old person, and everybody in the new system was a young person.
Right.
I'm not sure you can do that.
Right.
But obviously, the ones who went for liberation were quite young.
Wow.
I say that because Charles V was 19 years old, and the Holy Roman Emperor.
Yeah.
So he was a great force in keeping things the way it was.
Right.
Obviously.
Right. Thank you for that. That is very inspiring to me. A lot of Protestant seminaries have closed, right? Bangor Theological Seminary in Maine, now, most recently, Andover Newton in Boston. So this is a moment, I think, when we need to be retrieving our Protestant past and retrieving the basis of that past. Luther had two banners flying over the Reformation. One was what?
Semper Reformanda.
Yes. And the other was Sola
Scriptura.
Right. So I have to admit, you know, I feel a certain impulse, a calling. Right? I would like to be more of an advocate of a renewal of the Reformation spirit in regard to the generations and the future of the church.
If we could only get younger people trained in politics.
Yeah, that's true. We don't have any now. That's true.
with their own thinking.
Yeah.
And decent.
Right.
Honest.
Right. Right.
Well, religion, of course, can influence them.
Yes. That's exactly right.
There's a bit of an anti-establishment institutional mentality anyway that applies to, you can,
yes,
it applies to government as well as to religion.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
We're losing him, not necessarily to faith, losing him to the institution of the church.
Right. I watched in my years teaching in the seminary, but before I went to the university, when I began teaching at McCormick Theological Seminary in Chicago, the MA students, the MDiv students, were wonderfully young, right? And a bunch of my teaching assistants, Craig Wansink, Yun Chun Han, Nicole Wilkinson, right? They were all ordained and went on to serve God, to serve the church in wonderful ways as pastors and professors. But while I was there at McCormick, in the 6 or so years that I was there, I watched the age of people in the seminary creep up to the point where the majority of the students I was teaching by the time I moved here in 1991 were what?
Second career.
And older than me at that time. Now it's hard to be older than me. But, and then when I got to United, when I got to United Theological Seminary, there were almost no young people in the student body when I taught there. So I think, you know, the agenda for the churches, especially those churches that are the heirs of the Reformation and are committed to always reforming, Lutherans first of all, and then also Presbyterians and some Episcopal churches, I think the agenda for us has to be empowering young people as leaders. And I would like to be involved in that. I'm no longer teaching in the seminary, but I would like, in the years coming, I would like to volunteer. That's why I serve as a consultant for the Fund for Theological Education.
This is phenomenon is true not only for Lutherans and Protestants, but also for Roman Catholics.
That's true.
I was speaking with the priest at Incarnation. He's 70,
right,
and he needs to retire because he has Parkinson's, but he can't.
He can't.
Because they don't have any priests. And
right.
I said, well, we are in trouble because there were 55 in my class, and I think there might have been 7 or 8 in the current class.
Wow.
MDiv students.
Wow.
He said, well, there were 20 in my class, and there were 2 last year.
Wow.
So we share this.
Yep. We sure do.
This deficit of young people.
We sure do. One of my most beloved colleagues at Fordham University is our patristics scholar, Joseph Leonhard. Father Joe, he's a Jesuit, is 77 years old now. And he and I had dinner with him, Diane and I, we had dinner with him a couple of weeks ago in the Bronx. And after a couple of glasses of wine, the conversation became more personal and freer. And he told us with tears in his eyes, he said, I would have retired 2 or 3 years ago if there were a young person coming along to replace me. So you're exactly right.
Seems
yes.
Like the younger people tend to get involved only when there's great social discord. Like during the Second War, a lot of people then moved into the things into the 50s. And then after Vietnam, made a lot of people get involved. But if things are comfortable, young people are not going to risk getting involved in some of these things that are more challenging.
Right.
Terry, I would offer, and you know where I'm coming from, it's not the age differences that set up the problem. It's the motive. Okay? Today in Europe, there are churches that were in the Russian zone. They were kind of taking sponsorship and encouragement by the Missouri Synod. Missouri Synod does not want to ordain women.
I see.
Okay? So now you have a conflict. You have women, you have young people, you have older people who are in favor of ordaining women.
I see.
There is a group that's fighting that.
Uh-huh.
Okay? If we go back to Council of Nicaea.
Right.
The issue came down, what happens upon death? How did we resolve that? Well, we excommunicated guy and got rid of the argument.
Yes, right.
Okay. The issue is when we're faced with, what would you say, theological issues
yes,
that divide
yes,
us.
Yes.
How do we resolve those? And let's accept the fact you'll have young, middle-aged, old. You will have women. You will have men. You will have people of sexual orientation between the two extremes. you will have technology drives you, new information,
right.
Copernicus.
Right.
Okay? You're not liberating yourself or retrieving a better past by affirming that the sun goes around the earth.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
The question is, how do we resolve these issues in a proper manner without offending the other side and without having a split?
Right.
Epiphany was split several years ago, exactly because we failed to discuss.
Interesting.
We ignored an, social issue that was descending on us for about 20 years, maybe 30. We kept quiet. We played as if it doesn't exist. We kicked the can down the road. And I'm talking about the Synod and the whole ELCA.
Right.
How do we focus on these things, not just as the young, but all of us in this room and in this congregation?
Right. We will continue to offend.
You are right to point.
Well, what?
We will continue to offend.
I think you are right to point to the importance of theology, of what we believe. I agree with that. And if you all invite me back next year, I promise to devote my work next year to something more theological, something closer to our understanding of the life of faith. I'll have to decide what that ought to be, but I promise that I'm serious about what you're saying here, that theology is not incidental, it's the crucial factor. Now, as it relates to
how we might today begin empowering young leaders, I'll just close with one little anecdote.
Before you close,
yes,
can I little footnote to what I said?
Please.
In the light of your promise you made,
yes.
Who has seen the ecumenical Lutheran Catholic service celebrating the 500-year anniversary? Okay, I think you would agree that that was a wonderful dialogue between two warring factions. And if you haven't seen it, take a look at it.
Thank you.
It's available on YouTube.
Oh, good.
It takes about an hour and a half. It's in that order.
What was the date of it?
October 31st, 2016.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's going to be done again at Wittenberg University, October 29th, Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock. This year, with the Archbishop of Cincinnati and our bishop leading, where Francis and Martin Yomi of the Lutheran World Federation.
Wow. Yeah. When you listen to the words,
that's great.
They had all culture, major cultures there, the blacks, you name it, different languages, and they brought them together, and the words they used and the papers they signed, what a way to reestablish peace.
Thank you. That is great.
Observe that.
Yes, Jim.
A second, because I think what you were talking about is being able to have a dialogue and have a discussion. So it's kind of like it brings back the art of debate.
Yes.
But also the other point is from conflict to communion, that process that led to the worship service that continues today is a venue to have a conversation to explore differences and to consider how you tell the story moving forward.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
And come walk away in unity.
Right. Right.
That's a great place to end. That's wonderful. That's a great place to end. Thank you all so much for having me here this year. Please have me back next year. I'll do something more theological.
So I'm going to have to petition to him come back. I'm going to have a petition.